All right, this is David Spence. I'm here today with Michael Weber. Michael is the Josie Centennial Professor of Energy Resources. That's within the Department of Mechanical Engineering, right, Michael, at the University of Texas. And he's also the Chief Science and Technology Officer at ENGIE, a global energy company based in France, involved in the gas and the electricity sectors. And your charge in that position also includes research aimed at achieving ENGIE's decarbonization goals. Is that right, Michael?
That is correct. So I lead the corporate research department, and the research ecosystem at ENGIE is quite large in global nature. And we are trying to do the research to prepare the company for the future being a decarbonized future. So how do we decarbonize the energy system while keeping it affordable and reliable?
Great. Well, thanks for sitting down to talk to us with Energy Trade-Offs today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
The reason I reached out to you is because you wrote a really interesting series of tweets, a thread on Twitter about a month or two ago, offering your thoughts and your perspective on renewable natural gas. And I wanted to talk about some of the ideas you raised there. And let's start by talking about what you mean when you say renewable natural gas.
That's a great question. So renewable natural gas, or RNG, is a form of methane that comes from renewable sources rather than fossil reservoirs. So the typical natural gas we are familiar with is the gas is extracted from below ground. It could be from a coal seam, in which case it might be called coal gas or coal seam gas or coal bed methane, or it could come from other fossil reserves usually associated with oil production or unassociated, produced directly from shale formations or other places, more classic petroleum and geosystems engineering. So a typical way we get methane is to extract it from these reserves, but it turns out there are several ways we can make methane on a renewable way in a recurring way by, for example, decomposing organic sources. This might be wastewater sludge or food waste or agricultural waste. We can decompose it without oxygen present, so anaerobically decompose it to form methane. We can also manufacture methane from extra electricity where we crack carbon out of CO2 and crack the hydrogen out of water vapor and put them back together to make CH4, which is renewable methane. So when I think of renewable natural gas, I really mean renewable methane, which could be from these biogenic sources or these renewable electricity sources. If you look at the life cycle of a fuel, usually you're taking the key components from a reservoir and then you're dumping the waste components into a different reservoir. And the way we do it with traditional fossil production is the reservoir is below ground, and that reservoir could be a coal, oil, or gas. And let's say for gas, we take the carbons that are below ground reservoir, we burn them and use them, and then we dump the waste products in another reservoir, which is the atmosphere. But if you are to synthesize methane using excess wind or solar electricity by cracking the carbon out of carbon dioxide and then cracking the hydrogen out of H2O, your reservoir in that case is usually the atmosphere. So you're taking the carbon out of the atmospheric reservoir, cracking it, turning to methane, burning it, and then dumping your CO2 into the same reservoir, the atmosphere. Rather than using a reservoir that's below ground and then dumping above ground, you are starting in the same place you end. And that closes the loop, and that reduces your total life cycle carbon dioxide emissions.
The Twitter thread that provoked this conversation was really about the idea that this kind of energy source, renewable natural gas, may have an important role to play in a decarbonizing or decarbonized energy future. Can you elaborate a little bit on the sort of basic logic of that?
Yes, absolutely. So as a company at ENGIE, we have a mixed view of the world. Mixed meaning we are in the electricity space and the fuel space. And a lot of utilities are often just a gas utility or just an electric utility, but we have a combined view. And there are other utilities like that at a local level or other countries. And that combined view gives us unique perspective into the benefits, the upside benefits and downside risks of each option. And we love electricity, and we would love for the world to electrify because we are the world's largest independent power company in the world. We would love to sell you more electricity. But we recognize the limits on how far electricity takes you. It's hard to electrify everything without it becoming very expensive or unreliable. There are hard to electrify sectors, say steel, cement, aviation, shipping, that kind of thing. And so fuels probably play a role. And if fuels play a role and you care about decarbonizing, then you have to decarbonize fuels. But once you've decarbonized fuels, maybe you can use them other places, for example, in the power sector or for home heating and cooking. So we have to figure out how to decarbonize fuels one way or another. And it's with that view that we look at it as individual researchers, as professors, or at ENGIE with a corporate lens. How are we going to decarbonize that gas? And we have a gas system. We move fossil gas through it. That fossil gas might from come from Qatar, or might come from Russia, or might be LNG from West Texas or whatever. We're getting that gas, that fossil gas, sending it through the pipes to our customers. What can we do to decarbonize that system and recognize that those pipes around the world in total represent trillions of dollars of sunk steel on the ground? There's a lot of value in the pipes and in the burners and the boilers and the cooktops and that kind of thing. Well, one way is to electrify some of the end uses. Get rid of some of the uses for gas at the end of the pipe. You can electrify heating, water heating, cooking, that kind of thing. In some places that makes sense. You could also, that reduces your total demand for gas, by the way. So maybe you can electrify half the gas demand. I don't know, something like that. So your total gas demand gets cut in half. Then you have this remaining half. Maybe you can use biogas to replace a fifth of that, which is like 10% of total demand. And maybe if you're really in a place with robust organic materials, Europe, Latin America, Southeast Asia, but not the Middle East, by the way, and not big parts of the United States, then maybe you can reduce the total fossil gas demand by another 10 or 20%. Then maybe you can do renewable methane where you're manufacturing methane from excess electricity for the rest. So we can cut gas demand with conservation, efficiency, electrification, biogas to replace some, manufactured gas to replace the rest. And if that's too expensive, you go with fossil gas but add carbon capture or something else. So I think that any way you slice it, renewable gas as one of those options makes sense.
You said at the outset of that last answer that it's not possible, or it's not advisable to electrify absolutely everything. There are people in the popular debate that take issue with that assumption. Any examples you can give us to illustrate why you think it's not advisable because of those trade-offs to electrify absolutely everything?
Yeah, so you can electrify everything. It's just a matter of cost and reliability. And electrifying aviation is not impossible. It just sounds really expensive because it limits the size of the planes or how far they can travel, that kind of thing. There are certain types of light-duty, short-haul aviation that might be fine for electrification. Same thing with steel and cement. You can electrify, but will that change the price or the value? So we should electrify what we can. And the obvious examples, there's a lot of new build with electrified heat or water heating that'd be fine. And light-duty vehicle transportation is an obvious candidate for electrification. So let's electrify the things that are obvious. But if your goal is really get to zero carbon as quickly as possible, as cheaply as possible, and as robust a way as possible, then keeping fuels as part of the mix is important. We did a study at ENGIE just looking at Europe, and we found that the way to get to zero carbon the fastest is to increase the use of electricity from about 35% of consumption to about 53%, but at least 47%, which is consumption of fuels, which should be biofuels, fuels of capture, offsets, that kind of thing. And I think that's really the question. Do we want to go to 100% electrification, or is there some number below 100% we should stop to get better reliability? The reliability problems show up in different ways. One is with electricity, we have to overbuild our capacity to accommodate peak demand. Peak demand in a place like the United States is typically in the summer for air conditioning load, because air conditioning load is electric. But if we go to a lot of electric heating, it would shift our peak demand to the winter. And that's fine. We could have two peaks in the year, a winter peak and a summer peak. But the winter peaks are really peaky. They are sharper upswings in demand and sharper downfalls, because a cold snap can come through and in a couple of days really drive up electric demand in a way that a heat wave doesn't do in the same way. The cold snaps really drive electric demand in a way that air conditioning does not. Air conditioning really tends to build up over months and then die off over months. So all of a sudden you have a peakier system. You can electrify a peaky system, but it means you have to build a lot of extra capacity, which is therefore idled a lot of the time, and it becomes more expensive. And because the reliability is really around peak demand, not total consumption. So you are increasing the peak of the demand, but lowering the average consumption, which is really bad economically. And that's where it's nice to have fuels or things that are easy to store available. Fuels are a natural storage mechanism for energy. So that's one reliability issue and a cost issue. We have to overbuild our system if we go all electric. Then there are some technical issues around how the grid performs, which is if we turn on a bunch of electric resistance heaters at the same time, they mess up the harmonics of the grid. They don't have the three-phase operation and the beautiful harmonics because they are not rotating machinery. So it'd be difficult to do this with electric resistance heaters. So instead, we use heat pumps. Heat pumps have rotating devices, and so they don't mess up the harmonics the same way. But heat pumps also become less effective as it gets really cold. They're better in mild climates. And so you get a performance limit on heat pumps or a performance limit on resistance heaters. And if it's heat pumps, to back it up, we use fuels. if you're going to keep fuels in the mix to back up the heat pump, well, then you might as well decarbonize the fuels. You might as well figure out the fuel system. So those are some technical issues. They're all solvable. None of these are impossible. It's just a matter of price. Is it cheaper to solve the electric problems or just to solve the gas problems to back up the electric problems? And in our view, in a reasoned view from NG, is that actually decarbonizing gas might be a pretty cheap way to go compared to 100% electrification and all the overbuild of that capacity.
A lot of people pin their hopes on batteries as sort of a backup for wind and solar. Obviously, Mark Jacobson's model is sort of the most famous version of this, but wind, water, solar plus batteries, I guess now.
Wind, water, solar, and lithium, right?
Is really what it
should be, right?
Yeah. And Bernie Sanders' plan has ruled out nuclear and fossil as well. So what does your research show about the relative sort of trajectories of decarbonizing methane or gas and versus batteries?
I mean, if you want to build a system that is reliable, then you need to have some sort of physical hedging. This is true of any system, right? We have corn silos for corn. We have storage reservoirs for water. We have all sorts of physical commodities. They have storage built in. Crude oil has storage, natural gas has storage. And with the power system, we have not built in much store. It's a just-in-time or real-time demand system. And that's one of the reasons why we have to overbuild it, is because we don't have great capacity to store it other than pumped hydroelectric reservoirs in certain locations. We don't have much of that in Texas, but we have it in Colorado or Switzerland and that kind of thing. So there's limited storage in electric grid, and adding more physical storage would improve our ability to deal with the peaky demand from these weather events. And if you could build more pumped hydro, we should build more pumped hydro. Batteries are another solution for that. We know batteries. We're familiar with them. They're on the phone I'm using to speak with you right now. They're in the battery of the laptop you're using to record this conversation. So batteries are so ubiquitous. They're so familiar. We really like them. And the challenge with batteries is that at large scale, they become pretty expensive. At the small level of a consumer electronics device, the battery might be a couple hundred bucks. It's not that big a deal. But at large scale, can easily become billions of dollars per large power plant. So we got to be careful with it. They also take up a lot of space, which can be a problem. They also have great performance benefits. They're very fast. We know how to use them. So there are a lot of benefits of batteries, but some downsides. And I think in the end, it's the bulk storage where they are most limited. They cannot store as much energy as a snowpack on top of a mountain or a pumped hydroelectric reservoir or a cavern of gas below ground. And if you really want to look for energy density for storage, fuels are pretty powerful storage mechanisms. And this is why gas is pretty interesting. In fact, we end up storing our electricity as epoxy in these natural gas caverns where we store the gas in these caverns, waiting for the season when we need the gas to burn it to make electricity or to burn it to make heat in our homes. So that physical hedging is important for every physical commodity. And for electricity, what's the best way to physically hedge it? Probably a mix of solutions. Battery give you the fast performance. It can be located many places, but they don't give you the bulk performance. That's where fuels or snowpack or elevated water do.
And they also have the benefit of being there for sort of those rare long-term droughts in wind and solar energy as well, correct?
Yeah, wind droughts where you can go a few weeks at a time with some of these weather systems in Europe where you just don't get wind, and unless you have offshore wind off the coast of Ireland or something, but the continental wind can really slow down for weeks at a time. The water droughts can happen for years at a time. So whether it's a multi-week event or multi-year event, you want some sort of backup. And that could be fuels. It could be other forms of renewables like geoenergy as well, or biomass, that kind of thing. But we need something to fill in when wind is not available, just like we need something to fill in when nuclear or coal are not available because they're doing maintenance or refueling. We always have to have backups built up and in mind.
Your company's in Paris, and France is sort of a leader in nuclear, but nobody seems to be thinking optimistically about the future of nuclear. And I guess that you would probably also be in that category.
Well, we are a global company. We're in 70 countries. France is our headquarters, but we're also active in Belgium. In fact, we have 7 nuclear power plants in Belgium. So we have a nuclear fleet, and we love having low carbon power from nuclear. At the same time, we're not planning to build any more because it's so expensive and takes so long to build new nuclear. In the same amount of time, we could build a lot of wind and solar. Wind and solar are very cheap to build, very easy to build, they're very quick to permit. You can go from permit to construction to turning on in months to years rather than years to decades. And so for us, it's better to keep our nuclear fleet alive but not build new nuclear until the permitting and prices change substantially. which might happen, by the way, with small modular reactors and things like that. We're keeping an eye on it because we like low carbon.
One of the things you mentioned in the Twitter thread, which I just think is an important point, is that you make, and I'm going to paraphrase, so correct me if I'm wrong, but you said something toward the end of it, like we don't really know what the future holds in terms of the competitiveness and effectiveness of all these technologies. Why rule out any particular technologies or any particular players in the field right now as we plan to decarbonize? And can you elaborate on what you meant by that?
I think this is a really important point. It is actually one of my main motivations for writing that thread. By the way, it's funny to write a 1,500-word Twitter thread in response to a 4,000-word article. So I went over the top. But I think that there's a pressing need to solve climate change. This is the global thing we have to solve along with the pandemic. And for me, it's more important for us to set the standards for what we expect, which is decarbonize as quickly as possible, as cheaply as possible, and as resilient as way as possible, while also not violating our views of social justice and everything else. Like, we should set the standards and goals. And then we should say, everybody, here are the standards and goals, comply, get with the program. And if you can comply with the standards and goals, then that's great. You should do it. If you can't, then you can't participate. But I think starting up front with a list of who can't even try is not appropriate. We have a lot of environmental groups saying nuclear is not allowed to be part of this. We have environmental groups saying any fossil fuel company is not allowed to be part of this. Gases can't be part of this. Coal can't be part of it. Like, so people are interested in making lists of who cannot participate in this future. And I would say, well, if you're telling a lot of people that they can't be part of the future, then they will fight that future because they want to have a place in the future. And that means individuals, but also means companies. But if you're saying, hey, everybody, it's an all hands on deck kind of moment, we need everybody to get on board with decarbonization. Everybody has a role to play. As long as you can decarbonize, you're welcome to the party. Then we can all think the ways that we might engage. And it turns out there's a lot of capabilities in oil and gas or coal mining that might be relevant. Maybe we don't want coal the old way, but maybe coal with carbon capture makes sense in some places. And maybe there's something to learn from coal mining that we could apply to mining other minerals. Or maybe there's coal mines are a source of clean gas, or maybe it's a place for us to store something. Who knows? I think right now, instead of making lists of who can't participate in the future, we should be setting the standards for that future and invite everyone to join.
Yeah, that logic certainly resonates with me, although I understand why people get angry at oil and gas companies or at utilities. They've given them on occasion reasons to be angry. But when you use them, that sort of anger to mobilize support for decarbonization, you sort of also feed that dynamic of wanting to write lists of who's excluded. And I hate to see that happen because I think it forecloses our options, the options that we're going to need.
Yeah, I think if we get to our low carbon future faster if we are all working together towards that goal. But if half of us are going one direction, half going the other direction, we don't make any progress. And I'd rather get everyone on board than seek retribution, so to speak.
Yeah, and also, you know, in the other sort of pressing issue is inequality in this world, economic inequality. And if we do it in unnecessarily expensive ways, we exacerbate that problem while we're solving the other.
Yeah, exactly right. That's my concern.
Michael, thanks so much for sitting down to talk to us. I really appreciate it. Stay safe. Thanks.
Thank you. Stay healthy. Appreciate the opportunity.